Hello and thank you for listening to this Farah's podcast. 93% of Black people in the UK have experienced hair discrimination, according to a survey conducted by Pantene this year, with hair touching without consent experienced by almost half who were surveyed, and one quarter saying they had been picked on at school or at work because of their hair. Joining me to discuss hair discrimination today are Aisha Casely Hayford, an employment solicitor, voice artist, and founder of Afro Archives UK, and Laith Delamy, a barrister specialising in discrimination at Old Square Chambers. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, thank you for joining us. So Aisha, I want to start with you. Can you please explain, what are the Afro Archives?
Of course. So Afro Archives is a programme that I created to compare the experience of people with different textured hair, but in order to find the through line of the experience of people with Afro-textured hair. And I do have another specific focal point on women's experiences. And I devised it based on the principle of indirect discrimination, taken from Section 19 of the Equality Act, which looks at comparative treatment when there is a neutral policy, so something that's applied to all but has a particular disadvantage for a group of persons. And for Afro Archives, that is persons with Afro textured hair. And the reason I use comparison is because it's really important to me that we're not operating in a bubble. We've all got issues, let's face it. So by using this comparative exercise in Afro Archives, I've got a chance to compare people's experiences. And what I've done so far is I've created podcasts looking at different cultures, from the Jewish Orthodox tradition wearing wigs, Asian communities with head coverings. And I've also done traveling workshops, getting people from all across the country to come and talk about hair. And then very specifically, I've got some YouTube videos, which are 24 short films called Afro Archives, A Performer's World, where I've interviewed my acting mates of different genders, ages, cultures, hair textures, and asked them very simple questions like, what do you do after you wash your hair? Would you shave your hair for a film? And through that, looked at how they feel with their hair and their experiences of discrimination.
That's really interesting. Thank you for giving us a flavour of it. And we'll all like go on, I think, the website and have a look. But I was just wondering, you referenced Section 19 of the Equality Act, Aisha. Are there sort of specific legal cases that inspired the creation of the archives as well?
Yeah, actually, a case that got me particularly fired up. So I'd begun the Afro Archives programme on my own initiative, just through having chats with some of my girlfriends that I was on set with, and we all had different hair textures. So we had already highlighted something funny was going on. But then in 2016, there was this case in the US, and it was a case by it is a situation that happened to an individual called Chastity Jones, but formally the case was taken on by the EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, which is the US federal agency that enforces their civil rights in the workplace, protecting against discrimination. So they bring this case against this company called Catastrophe Management Solutions. Plenty of jokes made about that. This company, Catastrophe Management, has offered this woman, Chastity Jones, a job, but has said on offering it to her that she needs to cut her hair. Her hair at that time is in dreadlocks, or more specifically what we might call sister locks, because there are, I won't go into that, that's a whole other podcast. Basically, it's in locks. It was also blonde, which is a side point, but this is a problem with the case, because at a very first preliminary level, the courts cut it off because they said that the locks were a hairstyle choice, which meant that they were mutable and therefore not a race issue. Now, in the US, afros are protected, and this case has meant that locks are not. And the reason it disrupted me was because it showed me there was a very basic misunderstanding about the care of Afro hair and the experience of having Afro textured hair. They're protecting Afros, but quite simply, not every person of African descent can even grow an Afro. So there's just a really fundamental loss of communication going on about what it is to have Afro-textured hair. And then moving over to the UK, there was this case, not really a case, a situation that happened at Harrods. And I picked up on it because it was reported by the Telegraph. And what had happened was a woman had gone for a job and then had been asked to chemically straighten her hair. And in the same situation with the Chastity Jones case, we have a dress code, a policy, grooming policy being applied. And under that, this idea of unprofessionalism connected to hair. Now, what happened with this Harrods situation was that it was actually linked to gender discrimination, and it wasn't identified strictly as a race discrim case. So the same with the Chastity Jones case. Hair, Afro-textured hair, is not being linked into the race discrimination conversation. And so the Harrods case, they were also talking about wearing high heels and other things like that. So for me, Afro Archives UK, the programme, is about raising awareness of the journey of Afro-textured hair, what it means to maintain it, look after it, live with it, and just have a resource of information. So when these cases and discussions are coming up, you've kind of got direct word from the horse's mouth of what is actually taking place. And I'm hoping that's an offering that starts to dispel some of the misunderstandings.
Thank you. I mean, it's fascinating. You mentioned there the sort of lack of legal, I mean, the difference to start with between the US and the UK in terms of its approach. But just to bring Laith in at this point, Laith, our good friend, the Equality Act, there's no protected characteristic, is there, of hair. So how does a sort of case involving hair get litigated in the UK courts? What's the legal framework that would apply in the context of hair discrimination?
Well, it's, as Aisha has mentioned, it's Section 19. Section 19 of the Equality Act 2010, indirect discrimination. But in a way, before you even start looking at Section 19, you've got to identify the relevant protected characteristic. And so there are a number of characteristics that are protected under the Equality Act. Sex, age, race, religion or belief, sexual orientation, etc. Generally speaking, with hair discrimination claims, the relevant protected characteristic is race. And under Section 9 of the Equality Act, race includes colour, nationality, and ethnic or national origins. Sometimes, indeed, as Aisha has mentioned, cases relating to hair discrimination rely on different protected characteristics under the Equality Act 2010. Sometimes with women, that can be sex. Occasionally, it can be religion or belief. Occasionally, it can be age. But generally speaking, we're looking at race as the relevant protected characteristic. So then we go to Section 19, and there are a number of hurdles, essentially, that anyone bringing a hair discrimination claim has to jump over. The first is that there has to be what Aisha called a neutral policy. In the terms of the Act, that's a provision, criterion or practice, what discrimination lawyers often call a PCP. So essentially, you've got to identify what the PCP is. Now, often with an organisation, it will have a written policy, a personal appearance policy or grooming policy, however it might want to call it. With a school, for example, you'll have a uniform policy. So generally, there will be a written policy, but sometimes it'll be just a general way in which the rules are applied. So the written policy might say one thing, but if actually in practice they work in a different way, then the PCP might well be the way the rules work in practice. And so you have to identify the PCP, and then essentially the PCP has to be discriminatory in relation to a relevant protected characteristic, here race. So in a way, the first hurdle is, once you've got this PCP, does the organisation apply it to persons with whom the relevant person does not share the protected characteristic? So, for example, with a protected characteristic of race, does the organisation apply the policy to people of that racial group and people not of that racial group? Then, if so, does the policy, the PCP, put persons with whom the person bringing the claim shares the characteristic at a particular disadvantage when compared with persons with whom the relevant person does not share it? So looking at Afro-textured hair, putting people with Afro-textured hair at a particular disadvantage, which is, you know, a legal term which essentially means any sort of disadvantage, roughly speaking, when compared with people who don't have Afro-textured hair. And then, of course, the policy or PCP has to put the person bringing the claim at that particular disadvantage, himself or herself or themselves. Mm. And finally, the employer or organisation has a chance in a way, you know, even if it has discriminated, even if the person bringing the claim has got over all of those hurdles, the organisation has a chance to say, oh, well, no, it's lawful because it's justified.
Yeah, the key difference between direct discrimination and indirect being that the latter can be justified, as you've said. So how would an organisation, and it'd be helpful, I think, to talk through, if you can, like a practical example, employer organisation applies a PCP, it does have a disproportionately discriminatory effect on people possessing a certain protected characteristic, then how do they justify it? What's the mechanism for justification?
So they've got to identify what their aim is. Why are they putting why are they applying this policy? And it has to be a legitimate aim. It has to be legal, can't be discriminatory in itself, must represent a real objective consideration. So, for example, health and safety. Health and safety is nearly always a legitimate aim, but then you've got to consider, you can't just say, oh, health and safety, and everyone goes, oh, well, that's all right then. Because what the organisation then has to do is to show that applying the policy is a proportionate means of achieving that legitimate aim. It's reasonably necessary. There's no less discriminatory way of doing things. So, for example, in an employment context, let's say someone turns up at work and they're not abiding by the grooming policy. You know, let's say that there's a male employee, he has his hair in cornrows, the grooming policy says no cornrows. Now, if the employer decides to dismiss him on the spot, summarily dismissal, get out of the office, that is quite clearly not going to, even if it had the most legitimate aim in the world, difficult to see what that could be. But even if it had the most legitimate aim in the world, the question there would be, well, actually, is dismissing someone on the spot a proportionate means of achieving that legitimate aim? Is there something else that could be done? And there almost always will be something else that could be done short of dismissal.
Yeah, okay. I can see that in these cases, the real deciding factor is going to be the justification angle. Aisha, what do you think about, in terms of where the UK is now in respect of the Afro hair conversation? How, you know, it's kind of surprising perhaps to hear that employers might still have policies in place or PCPs in place, which, you know, do disadvantage people with Afro textured hair. But what's your kind of experience of where the UK is?
I feel really positive about it, actually, and there have been some very defining cases that have begun to put the conversation out there, which is the beginning of all change. So I feel really positive. Some of the great positivities can be seen in everywhere. For example, you can go into Boots Superdrug now and see products for Afro-textured hair. When I was younger, that was completely unheard of. So my only thing is, why now? Like, I wish I had this, because it's not just about having it there so it's easily accessible for you and I don't have to travel. You know, I grew up in Kent. I, you know, have to go to London to get the hair products that I needed from places where there was a more density of people with Afro-textured hair, so a higher supply. So not only that, but it's also about the normalization of those products. So it's not something unique. No, it's just common, and it can be on the shelf in Boots and I can get what I need there, and everyone else knows that that's just as normal, and maybe they can try it on their hair, because our hair is unique and different and people come from many different cultural backgrounds. So it's also just an acceptance of that interconnectivity, you know, that we can all start sharing each other's products and cultural backgrounds and hair textures and things like that, and just not making it such an extreme difference. There's also poster campaigns. One of my friends, Lecky Alay, has this poster campaign called Project Embrace, and it's all around the country, and she specializes in taking great pictures of people with Afro-textured hair, just to put it out there that this is what the hair looks like and see it more. And can't have a conversation like this and not mention George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement, but all of that is helping the conversation become legislation. For example, the UK National Occupational Standards for Hairdressing, all UK hairdressers have to learn how to style Afro-textured hair. And a lot of the problem we've had is theatres, film sets, people not having the knowledge. We've also got the Halo Collective, which is an alliance of organisations and individuals working to end hair discrim. So maybe these changes are not immediate, but they're putting the conversation on the table. They're helping us to speak up, to identify issues, have the language to articulate what's wrong, say what we need without having to write a whole novel about it and people looking at us curiously. I think now, hopefully, there aren't many people that you can say, "Don't touch my hair," and not just sing the Solange song, but really know what that means, that that's not okay. Like, just putting in those boundaries. So I think the UK is in quite a healthy place, at least for discussion, if not for really filtering down what those changes should be.
Yeah, well, I'm pleased to hear that. And then more specifically then, Aisha, I mean, drawing on some of your own experience as a woman with Afro-textured hair, I mean, what insider learning points or words of wisdom would you have to share with people who are perhaps responsible within their organization for writing or reviewing a grooming code or a workplace dress code? How can they make sure that they are writing that in such a way that it's not going to have an indirectly discriminatory effect?
Firstly, thank you so much for asking me. And I think that's the point to begin with. Keep having conversations with people who should be around the table when these grooming codes policy documents are being made. Look around that table. Do you have individuals with Afro-textured hair? And of course, it doesn't end there. It should always be wide. You should always be making sure you've got people from different backgrounds and cultures as decision makers. And if you don't, engaging a relevant consultant for their input. Being ready to have the conversation, being open to views that you may not understand, but in recognition of how different we all are, asking probing questions, why are choices being made? For Afro-textured hair in particular, there are maintenance choices that you may make. I began talking about Chastity Jones and locks. Having your hair in locks is a hairstyle that may be taken for well-being. It is a natural way that the hair coils. It means you don't have to do a million different things at nighttime and in the morning to maintain it. My hair is natural, and it's out, and I have to twist it at nighttime if I want certain styles. If I had locks, I wouldn't have to do that. So there are different things that you may do with your natural hair that allow you to maintain it and have it for a long period of time. The direction it grows in, up and out, may also affect a choice that you may make. Lots of young girls have their hair, we call it in the pineapple, which is putting the hair up in a ponytail and then the afro be free on top. That's also relevant to the texture of the hair because it's in accordance. We all know if you shave in the direction of this, that the hair grows on your skin. It's a similar principle with a hairstyle. So yes, it's a hairstyle choice, but it is relevant to the texture of the hair. And that's why we say afro texture, because it's specific. So ask these questions, get to the bottom of it, find out what's really going on and make sure the right people are around the table when you're drafting policies that, although considered neutral, may actually have a disproportionate impact on a specific group that is a protected group or otherwise, taking it wider for best practice. Just to add, I think another nice thing for decision makers is to also look at the things that are being included in respect of positive images. And if we're thinking about schools in particular, going back to this Project Embrace idea, that's a really good place to look for ideas of positive images, books that are being used, what's on display, what poster displays are being done. Because although so much change is happening, it's still a time for building confidence with natural hair styles and natural hair textures. And as I was saying about products and boots, it's also about normalizing different hair textures and styles, and that includes hair coverings as well. That's also a really lovely way for people who are decision makers and in power to help keep this a very relevant and inclusive topic.
Thank you, Aisha. And then same question to you, please, Laith. You know, what practically can organizations do to help prevent hair discrimination from taking place?
Well, I haven't got much to add to what Aisha has said. It's a case of consulting relevant people and making sure that affected groups are involved in the conversation about policies. One resource that employers or other organisations might want to make use of is one that's already been mentioned by Aisha. It's the Halo Collective. You can just type Halo Collective into Google. They have come up with a code, and it's relevant for schools, it's relevant for employers. Lots of schools have adopted it. Lots of big employers like Unilever have adopted it. And it has input from, it's actually written by people who these policies affect, people with Afro-textured hair. So there's consultation and getting input from relevant people, but also there are other things. There's training to people writing the policies and people in senior positions in organisations. That might be unconscious bias training, it might be racial sensitivity training, might be equality and diversity training, including anti-racism training more generally, might be a mixture of, or indeed all of, those three. And training to people in the organisation. So with employers, that can be to employees. With schools, it can be to staff, to governors, and to pupils, or a mixture of those. And then other than that, getting input from diversity experts, or where relevant, and you'd expect a lawyer to say this on the legal podcast, legal experts.
Great. Okay, well, thank you. This has been a really interesting conversation. It's a big topic. We've just touched, scratched the surface here, but I hope you've enjoyed listening, and thank you, Aisha and Laith, for your expertise and input.
Thank you so much. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you.